Revenue will come to order for March 15, 2007. We have three first public hearings scheduled for today. Excuse me. And we'll start the first public hearing on House Joint Resolution 37. Paul?
Chair, HJR 37 is an amendment, constitutional amendment. And what it does is states that the single subject rule in section one of the article does not apply to measures that relate to the subject of taxation, and so it would create an exclusion for those amendments that related to taxation, so you could have multiple subjects and not have to have a revision in this building. So, and it would submit the measure the next general election held throughout the state. I've also asked Ted Whitelinger to come by if you have any questions. Ted was the one who drafted that and has kind of tracked the single subject issue over the years.
Very good. Thank you. I note that Representative Dennis Richardson is here and would like to be heard on this measure. So let's start with you, if you would, Representative Richardson. Yes,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dennis Richardson, members of the committee. I'm here as a concerned citizen, and I encourage the committee to pass this House Joint Resolution number 37. The reason why this is important is it's become very obvious, I think, to all of us that there's questions about tax revenue, and so we have discussions about should we raise tobacco taxes, should we change the corporate minimum taxes, should there be taxes on auto insurance policies, should we have a sales tax. All of these tax questions are surrounding what really needs to be discussed, which is what is the appropriate tax policy for Oregon, and is it time for a change? If that discussion is going to take place, which would be the primary responsibility of this committee, then there should be the ability to make changes in the tax code if that were to be decided to be the appropriate course of action. Unfortunately, with a single subject rule, if there were to be changes in the tax code that would require constitutional votes, it could be easily seen that there would be more than one measure that would have to be dealt with. For instance, if this committee decided that it would be appropriate to reduce or eliminate a property tax and institute a sales tax, we could be in a situation where you would have separate constitutional amendments on these separate issues, and theoretically there could be, actually may not even be theoretically, the majority of the voters could say, we vote in favor of repealing the property tax, and we think maybe it's not time yet for a sales tax, in which case this committee would be confronted with new issues that they would have to resolve. And so merely as a policy consideration, this referral to the people says that if this body, after thorough discussion and vetting, decides that there needs to be a reorganization of our tax code, then multiple issues relating to taxation could be referred to the people within one bill. So if there was going to be a constitutional reduction in, say, property tax, and the institution of a sales tax, if that were to be decided, it could be in the same bill occurring on the same day, and the people would get a single vote on a restructuring that could only be changed by a future vote of the people, which I believe is going to be necessary if it's going to be a restructuring of the tax system that we have for Oregon. So I would suggest that to give this committee and this body the opportunity in the future, at some future time, to propose a restructuring of the tax system for Oregon and have it be able to be done in a single bill, that we first have to have a foundational vote to allow that to take place.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for Representative Richardson? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, so I guess I always assumed that the rationale for this requirement was so that because if people would vote for one provision but not for another, and that I think that's been the line of reasoning when the courts have thrown out some measures in the past, that you wouldn't want to have two measures that we might support one and oppose the other rolled in together. And so could you explain again what the rationale is for why that wouldn't apply in the situations that you're talking about?
My understanding, as far as the single subject rule, is to avoid a situation where an initiative comes before the people that has multiple provisions, some the people may really want, and others that may have different motives and have different consequences. And to avoid that kind of complex and confusing situation, we have a requirement that there be only a single subject in each bill that comes before the people. In the area of taxation, I believe that ultimately there's going to be a restructuring, and when that takes place, it would be wise for all facets of that restructuring to be in a single bill. This merely says that the single subject rule would not be violated in the area of a referral from this legislative body on the issue of taxation only. So that's what we're trying to do, is just provide a vehicle so that there could be a restructuring at some time in the future of all multiple tax issues all in one bill.
Okay. So, as I understand the proposal, it essentially removes the requirement that multiple tax measures coming together would have to be a part of a revision, which requires a two-thirds vote in each house of the legislature now, rather than this could be done if House Joint Resolution 37 were to pass. Then the legislature could propose multiple changes in the tax law. Amendments concerning taxation by a simple majority vote in each house. That would be the effect of this.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions for Representative Richardson? Thank you, sir. Appreciate your bringing this matter to us today and your excellent exposition of it.
Thank you.
Are there others who would like to be heard today on House Joint Resolution 37? Yes, please. Boy.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I hadn't planned on testifying, but I had want to make clear at least of our understanding because, as some of you may know, the interpretation of requiring single subjects under Oregon Constitution was developed by the ACLU through the Armada decision, which was originally what was called the Crime Victims Initiative. It had multiple changes around crime victim issues, and we measure 40. We had it overturned. And when it came back to you all the next session, because each part of that constitutional provision was brought back in separate bills, there were actually eight bills, and the body decided to send only seven out to voters, and the voters, I believe, passed four and rejected three. But my understanding of this proposal doesn't affect the two-thirds requirement of this body, and I'm not versed on that enough to speak to that, but it is my understanding that it would be different amendments to different parts of the Constitution, or if there are different tax issues, and that it would allow those to violate the single subject requirement to go to the voters. And I think, you know, as Representative Rosenbaum was raising, it's the log rolling issue is the issue of place. So I don't think it affects a referral out of this body in terms of votes within this body. What it does is it would allow you to put a package together, refer it out to voters, sort of like Measure 40 was, with a bunch of different issues that voters would do up or down on. And I just, you know, for the record, the ACLU has concerns about this because we like to be consistent in our policy arguments about things, and we get very concerned when exceptions are made. It might be, and this may be a very persuasive argument as to the problems with the taxation and the solutions that need to go forward. It would be our concern, though, that it might be another issue that would come before you all to amend the Constitution to allow more than one subject to be put to the voters in another issue, in another. And what's the standard we use? Where do we draw the lines in deciding what exceptions to the rule should happen? So I raise that concern that we have I want to make sure you're aware of that and the dynamics around the decision you have before you on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Mr. McIntyre?
Nobody put his hand up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I came to testify on another bill, but I just wanted to add something.
Excuse me just a moment. Would you state your name?
Don McIntyre.
Thank you.
Taxpayer Association of Oregon, citizen from Gresham. The one thing that I wanted to add to her remarks is to tell the committee not to confuse the Armada decision with the single subject rule. They are distinctly different. They're not one and the same. And I think when you do the bill, which I think has a good intent, just make sure that the language says this is about tax reform and that this can have different kinds of taxes in it. It is all the same subject. So I'm sure that's what you're after. The Armada decision, of course, says you can't revise separate parts of the Constitution even if you claim it's the same subject. Now, the legislature can get around that by simply doing a revision, but again, that takes the two-thirds vote. So I think just when you take a look at the language of it, if you really specify, listen, if we're going to have tax reform and it needs to be comprehensive, we want to put a lot of different kinds of tax subjects in there, and I think it'll be a good bill. It'll be worthwhile. And then one other comment. If you believe the legislature needs, or to become more efficient, would like to have that power, if it doesn't exist now, then remember the citizens would like to have that power as well when they do an initiative. And if they do an initiative that relates to taxation, they should have the same clearance under law. After all, in the Constitution, they are the primary legislature, as stated in Article 1. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Questions? Thank you. Ted, would you come up and talk about this measure a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ted Reutlinger from the Legislative Council's office. The last speaker was correct. There's a very big difference between the single subject requirement and the separate amendment, separate vote requirement in the Constitution. What we're talking about here is the separate amendment requirement, which flowed out of the Armada decision. It comes from Section 1, Article 17 of the Constitution. What it says is that whenever two or more amendments are submitted to the voters, they have to be submitted so that they may be voted on separately. And as you know, there have been several measures invalidated by the Oregon Supreme Court under this constitutional section, including some campaign finance things, term limits, victims' rights, and the first land use compensation measure 37 measure. Several other things have been upheld by the court. The single subject thing is a much easier test to meet. The single amendment requirement is far more narrow and more difficult to satisfy. In all of these cases, the court has set out a test that they look at to see if something has more than one amendment in it. And this applies to both initiative constitutional amendments and to amendments that are referred by the Legislative Assembly. The single subject does not apply to legislative referrals of constitutional amendments. It only applies to the initiative system and to initiative laws and initiative amendments to the Constitution. So the basic test is this. When the court looks at a constitutional referral for purposes of single amendment, it asks three main questions. Number one, does this proposal make two or more changes to the Constitution? Those can be explicit changes, amending Section 1, Article 8, for example. Or they can be changes that are implicit. If you were to put forward an amendment that would allow campaign contributions without referring to any section of the Constitution, that would clearly implicitly amend Section 1, Article 8 on free expression. The second question they ask is, are those changes substantive in nature? If they're just procedural little things, the court won't worry too much about those. finally, the changes have to be closely related. That's the tricky part of this analysis, and that's where people argue in court, is are the changes closely related? And what the court looks at is, first, what sections of the Constitution does the proposal amend, and are those sections related? If you have something amending free speech and something amending compensation for the taking of property, maybe those aren't closely related. The second thing to look at is the nature of the changes themselves to see if they are, in fact, closely related. And if the court determines that they're not closely related, the measure is invalidated. It's considered to be not validly enacted, and it's not good law. And so what this HJR 37 does, well, first, getting to the revision part, right now the legislature does have the authority to include as many amendments in a measure as they want to, amendments to the Constitution. However, to do that, you have to pass that by a three-fourths vote in both the House and the Senate to refer it out. So you could package a wide variety of measures into a constitutional revision now, but it's subject to a supermajority vote in the House and the Senate. What HJR 37 would do is eliminate that supermajority requirement just for amendments that relate to taxation. So you could package a variety of tax amendments to the Constitution that under the current system might not be considered to be closely related by a court. Court might look at a sales tax and a property tax thing as being two separate independent things that could stand alone, not necessarily related, and invalidate the measure if you were to just simply put them into a single amendment and call them that. What this would do is allow you to put more tax amendments into one referral and would subject it to just a simple majority vote for the House and the Senate, which would be different than the revision. So that's a basic summary of the single amendment law.
Wonderful. Questions? Yeah, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Ted. And with regard then to the initiative process, those folks coming forward with an initiative process to amend the Constitution on the subject of taxation, to revise our system of taxation, what's the applicability then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, under HJR 37, the initiative folks would not be affected. They would still be subject to both the single subject requirement and the single amendment requirement. This bill only addresses legislative referrals from the Legislative Assembly.
And as a part of that question, would you describe again briefly where the differences are now between the power, legislative power to refer matters for amendment to the Constitution and the power of doing it by initiative? Because they are different, aren't they?
They are very different.
Under current law,
the legislature may refer constitutional amendments under Article 17 of the Constitution. The single amendment provision applies to your standard referral of a constitutional amendment that's subject to a majority vote. Second, the legislature may refer a revision, which is subject to a supermajority vote and allows you to put in more than one amendment. The people have their authority under Section 1 of Article 4 of the Constitution to initiate laws and constitutional amendments. In Article 4, the people are subject to more than the legislature is, because the people have to meet both the single subject test for constitutional amendments and the single amendment test in Article 17. That's what the Armada case was about. The court said that the Article 17 single amendment provision applied to initiatives. So this resolution addresses only the legislative piece. It does not address the initiative powers of the people.
I guess the reason I ask the question is that we already have a system in which the initiative process is limited in a different way than the authority of the legislature to ask the people for a change in the Constitution.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Also, it's true that the people may not initiate a revision to the Constitution.
Right. I understood that from your first remarks. Are there other questions? Thank you. I appreciate the clarity with which you describe these existing different rules. I think there are many times when we get them confused, and getting another little précis in constitutional law is a useful thing for us.
Yes, I get nervous when people begin interchanging the single subject and single amendment language. While they're similar, they are, in fact, technically very different. So.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on the public hearing for HJR 37? If not, we'll close that public hearing. And and we will open a public hearing on HJR 46. Mary, this one is yours. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Joint Resolution 46 proposes an amendment to Oregon's Constitution that will permit counties and local taxing districts to increase their permanent rates to restore revenues lost when federal forest reserves are discontinued. Applies only to counties and taxing districts in which a certain percentage that hasn't been determined yet or greater of operating budget is funded by federal forest receipts. We'll refer this amendment to people in the next regular general election.
Okay. And you're also on 45, aren't you?
I think.
Yeah. I think I'm going to open a public hearing on HJR 45 at the same. So we're going to hear these two at the same time. Would you explain HJR 45 for us?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. HJR 45 basically will raise the maximum rate set under Measure 5, $1 for schools and $1 for non-schools. Currently, they're 5 and 10 for schools and non-schools, and it would raise that $1 each to 6 and 11.
And this is in a property tax limitation
That
was adopted as a part of Measure 5, was it not?
Yes, it was in 1990, I believe it was.
Okay. And the dollar rate you're talking about is a dollar per $1,000 of
real market
value.
Excellent.
Thank you. All right. And we have several witnesses on these two measures. So let's hear first from the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Oregon Cities, Gil and Andy. And yes, please bring up Mayor McArdle as well. Gentlemen.
Who would you prefer to start, Mr. Chair?
You're closest to the microphone.
Okay, I'm not too close. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Policy Manager, Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm asking the permission of the chair to let me speak a little bit beyond the two measures here, since HJR 46 addresses directly the Secure Rural Schools expiration.
And your comment essentially sets a background for these measures and some other things that may come before us.
Yes, I believe it'll be helpful.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you. On February 2nd, the Association of Oregon Counties made a major presentation to you describing the crisis situation that the state and counties face with the expiration of Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act of 2000. The material that I've given to you presents a summary of that to refresh your memory, titled Financial Situation of Counties in 2007, Why the Crisis. And just very briefly, the reason why this is a collective problem with the state and the counties is because counties share service delivery authority with you. We are, the red here shows that we are more often than not jointly delivering our public services with you than not. The Secure Rural Schools Act expired in 2006, and if the committee wishes, a little later I can give you an update about potential reauthorization, but the result of that was a loss of $107 million a year to county general funds. And I've also, again, returned to you this table entitled Complexity of Impacts, because each county finds itself in a somewhat different position with the result of the expiration of the Act. And so we need more than one tool to help ourselves out of this. Again, to refresh your memory, in 2003, the legislature faced a shortfall of the general funds of 13%, and you considered that catastrophic. If you look at the bottom line of losses as a result of PL 106393, it's 12.3%. You remove Multnomah and Washington counties, it's 20% per year loss of general funds by counties. Now, the majority of money, the majority of funds, discretionary funds spent by counties is on public safety. So that's what will take the hit. In terms of, and then we discussed very briefly the matters of structural handcuffs in the Constitution. Measure 50 made tax rates permanent. And we have counties with tax rates that vary widely. 59 cents is the low. And we have another that's 60 cents. The median, by one calculation for county government, is $2.58, which is quite modest. These counties also happen to be dominated by non-taxable federal and state public lands. So they cannot grow themselves out of this, even with a higher tax rate. But having the local jurisdictions refer to the people, a question of adjusting the permanent rate is a critical tool that won't solve the problem but will be very helpful. Just a note, 18 counties have more than 40% public ownership. So there just isn't that much economic development potential in many of these counties. There was also a complication of the change property ratio. I won't go into that now. We do have a tool of the local option property tax levy, but it's temporary. It's limited to up to 5 years. And it's subject to compression and the requirements, what are called the double majority requirements. Commissioners met on Monday, and my purpose today is to share with you a short list of ways that they would ask that you help them to help themselves. Each has been endorsed by ALC. There are two suggestions under removing constitutional structural handcuffs. Our first request is that you refer to the voters to establish a majority vote requirement for local levies in May and November elections of any year. the reason why this isn't as sweeping as some of the other proposals you've heard about this, other proposals would eliminate that the double majority requirement entirely. Rather, we're focusing on those elections where voters most commonly participate and when there's no surprise to the voter. The second constitutional improvement that we would ask that you consider is permit a county government to seek voter approval, then the county to change its permanent property tax rate. And that will take a statewide constitutional amendment to give that authority to counties. We are open to discussing reasonable limitations on this ability of county voters, but remember, it would be up to the voters themselves to adjust the frozen rate to fund state and local shared public services. This won't solve the problem, as I described, because in many counties the dominance is by tax-free lands, but it will be a critical tool. In terms of statutory suggestions, I might mention, since you're also hearing HJR 45, the commissioners did discuss the compression limits of Measure 5, and Multnomah County in particular noted that they are restricted by that. However, the commissioners decided that the two most important items that should be before the voters were the two I just mentioned, and that the other issue could come along some other time, but we did not want to overburden the ballot with constitutional amendments. So we recommend at this time that we have no position on that at this time. In terms of statutory changes, again, only two items that we ask for your help. First, a point of information. This is really a matter for the Ways and Means Committee, but we are requesting, with Ways and Means leadership, that the state general fund appropriation to the CAFA account, the statewide, the state A&T funding source account for the program, be increased from $5 million a biennium to $20 million a biennium. The reason for that is the $5 million represents a partial reimbursement for counties collecting property tax revenues for schools. It is the schools, in effect, the schools' contribution to this effort. Total county expenditures vary from year to year, but it's about $88 million a year, of which $23 million is from the CAFA account. Statewide, counties retain merely 19% of the collections. What the additional $7.5 million a year will provide from CAFA is that the CAFA share of A&T costs will increase to 65%, which is closer to the percentage of collections for the state K through 12 and ESD system, 40%. We're negotiating with leadership on ways and means now, but I give you that as a point of information because it is relevant to one of your items of jurisdiction, assessment of taxation. The two items that we request for statutory assistance is, first, we endorse the Department of Revenue's second option that they presented to you a couple of weeks ago about temporary waiver of A&T requirements, A&T standards. Temporary relaxation, not waiver, relaxation, excuse me. The one that was preferred, the version that would be preferred by AOC would be for a county affected by a reduction in federal forest payments to the extent of at least 10% of its general fund revenue, and that will affect 12 counties. It would not lose its CAFA grant if it reduces its certified A&T expenditures in a quarter by no more than the percentage of general fund loss. So, for example, County X loses 25% of its general fund revenue because of loss of federal forest revenues. They can, in a calendar quarter, reduce their A&T expenditures by up to, but no more than 25% for that quarter. This will permit hard-hit counties to continue to the revenue-raising activities that A&T provides while not unnecessarily jeopardizing public health and safety and not requiring DOR to become hands-on in the county and that additional expense to the state. And finally, a small item, we request that you amend ORS Chapter 451, the County Service District's law, to permit a district to be formed by the people for more than one purpose in the functions listed in that chapter. The functions of districts in that chapter include law enforcement, emergency communications, solid waste disposal, roads, agriculture, extension services, library services, and public transportation. None of these measures is a cure, but if you take these actions, then we will have more tools at the local level in order to help ourselves get us out of this crisis. So that's my remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I think we'll hear from the cities, and then we'll have questions for the whole panel. Thank you.
Sure. Andy Shaw with the League of Oregon Cities. I brought with me Mayor John McCardle. Let him speak first, and then I make some closing comments, if that's all right.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John McCardle. I'm the mayor of Independence. I'm past president of the Oregon Mayors Association. I'm currently a board member of the League of Oregon Cities. I have some short comments, and I make all the hard work go to Andy. When the voters enacted Measures 5 and 50, they were seeking relief from rising property taxes, but they weren't voting on what the effective rate for schools or what the right tax levy should be for public safety. They were voting for relief. But 5 and 50 have created a financial nightmare for local governments. You folks have talked to your local folks. You know the details. You know, when we get away from, you know, potholes and swimming pools and the kinds of thing and zoning and all those kind of things, you hear your mayors and city council members talk about what the challenges that they're facing. You know, it's the limits on local control and the arbitrary capping of property tax rates and the permanent tax rates. In my city, we can't do some of the things we want to do. We don't have any recreation programs that are provided by the community. We can't do that, even if our voters want to. Each one of your communities within each of your districts can tell you the things that they can't do, even if the voters wanted to do it, if their citizens chose to, because of the property tax rates. We're slowly strangling because of this arbitrary cap. This balancing act that governments have been doing at the local level for decades, we have local elections, we have public hearings, meetings, and then our voters make decisions about what we what we can have in our community. These rates make it difficult for our citizens to decide what they want to do. The rates were not set by the communities, and they can't be changed locally. You know, as you're just hearing, the counties, they didn't need high property taxes in the old days because they had timber revenue. Now, because of 5 and 50, they're stuck. They can't raise those rates without your folks' assistance. And they're limited in what they're able to do. They're jammed up. We need to make a change, a structural change here. You can't run a police department, a fire department, or any essential services when you don't have a guaranteed source of income. You know, we can go out and try to do serial levies. They only go for 5 years at a time. That's not an efficient way to run an operation. It's not a way to run a city. And what we cities need are tools so that we can provide the services that our communities are demanding. And we're going to grow in this state by over 1 million people in the coming years. And 75% of those folks are going to live in cities. We need you to help us help ourselves. We urge you to restore some local control to cities and counties by allowing us to revisit the permanent rates that were frozen under Measure 5. And more important, allow our citizens to determine for themselves what services and what they want in our local communities. Let the citizens decide what we want. Don't put arbitrary restraints on it. Andy, would you like to add some detail?
Thank you. From the city's perspective, there are three major issues we're facing. The Measure 5 cap, as you know, causes compression when the rates bump up against the limit. We've handed out this packet, which I think we gave to you last November, the interim committee last November. On page 6 of that, you'll see the number of cities that are running into compression on particular properties is growing, or has been growing over the past number of years, to the point where we're now more than half of the state's cities are experiencing compression. The following page, on page 7, shows the dollar value lost to compression, which has, in general, been growing over the years as well. So that's the first issue, which is addressed in, I believe, Measure 40, HJR 45 before you, by raising the caps to give some compression relief. And we support that. The second major issue is...
Excuse me just a moment. You said you support Measure 45. Is that what I heard?
We support raising the caps to allow some compression relief.
Thank you. Go ahead.
The second issue is the permanent rate prohibiting cities from raising that rate, and if folks locally want to establish a new service, they either have to establish a special district, which then dilutes local control over services that are provided and the places that people have to go to engage in their local government. The third issue is the disconnect between real market value and assessed value. The last page, on page 8 of this handout, shows the growing loss of value that is assessed in property, in new properties, in newly constructed properties. Each of these problems affects different cities in different ways. As was indicated, Multnomah County, the Portland metro area, I think the biggest issue there is compression and the loss of value when the caps are reached. In particularly rural counties that where rates were frozen at very low levels, they didn't have the chance to have a local discussion about what the appropriate rate was. It was capped arbitrarily. And the disconnect between real market value and assessed value affects all communities, but in particular growing communities where they're losing value on new homes and the ability to respond to growth by providing appropriate infrastructure, both on the school side and on the city side. So we would strongly encourage you to, we're very excited that discussions occurring about Measure 550 reform, and we would encourage you to take a more global approach than the two measures before you, which we think take limited but needed reforms in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, sir. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gil, you've got a number of counties that are facing some very difficult situations. I mean,
sure.
I put before the judiciary an opportunity for Oregon to adopt municipal acceptance under the federal bankruptcy codes, so that, and I don't know whether they're going to do that or not. Oregon is presently like California was before the bankruptcy of
Orange County
Orange County and San Bernardino.
Yeah.
my concern is that we need to have some of those things in place so that we can have orderly discussion. My question is, and this is also a city question too, when we have a county with a one particular permanent rate that has to be liquidated, does not have the assets to continue to operate, what happens with that county as it's absorbed into another county? Do we have any idea what the new tax rate looks like, the permanent tax rate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's a very good question. I understand the governor's office has asked the attorney general for a breadth of answers in that regard. And we're all learning about dissolution of a county and what happens, whether it's a choice to, whether the neighboring counties have the first choice, whether the whether there's some other mechanism. And what it seems, though, to me, that is just off the top of my head, that the permanent rate of the jurisdiction that acquires, that assumes that territory would be the permanent rate of that new territory as well. But that's just a guess.
Follow-up.
Yes, Chairman. Please.
Thank you. And Andy, I'm going to jump back to you now. The compression actually from 1999 with the full implementation of Measure 5 continued to go up through 04, 05. It shows a small decline in 05, 06. And you have the opposite problem of counties right now. Counties are considering actually collapsing from 36 down to some other number, but cities continue to grow. We have a new city, I guess, of Lapine recently. What happens, what's happened in 05, 06, and what happens in compression as cities continue to expand? You get a new city, for instance. Wouldn't that take some of those cities, particularly the newer cities, out of compression, or do they establish their own tax rate?
I think the rate of compression has come down a little bit because of rapid growth in real market value. When you get real market value going up, the rates aren't bumping up against that real market value for particular properties. So I think that's what's driving it. We think that overall the trend in the gap is going to continue to grow regardless of year-to-year changes up and down. And that's our concern. We're losing all that value, especially in fast-growing communities.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? I have a couple. I'm wondering if you could provide us with a list of those cities. If you could, it's easy to extrapolate then which counties and school districts are also in compression because they're territorially the same.
Sure, all that information is available.
I think that would be helpful for the committee. I simply wanted to note too, while we're talking about CAFA, that there has been a agreement from the speaker to draft a bill that would allow us to address the option 2 issue that the counties raised today, so that the committee will have an opportunity to introduce a bill and actually work on that. We looked and we couldn't find a relating clause, so the speaker has agreed to introduce a bill outside of the normal process in order to give us the opportunity to look at that. Would you say a little bit more about why allowing a special district to have more than one function, why that would be useful, helpful in dealing with these tax issues?
Mr. Chair, I believe I described it as a more minor of the four suggestions, the most
right.
Minor. I guess it would permit a county to go to the voters, reduce the cost of elections, go to the voters once for a county service district that may embody more than one function, so that instead of going one time for each particular function. For example, in the lists that are available, maybe a county would rationally go to the voters for a law enforcement and emergency communication services special district, as county service district, rather than go twice, once for each.
Okay, that makes I now understand the point you're making. Any other questions of that jogs from anyone? Thank you very much. We appreciate your attendance and explanation of your positions on these issues. And thank you, Mr. Mayor, for your attendance today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I still have vacation time, I think.
Oh, good. Mr. McIntyre.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Don McIntyre, Oregon Taxpayers Association, citizen from Gresham, Oregon. I came down to address specifically Joint Resolution 45, mainly because I have a seminal interest in that language, dating back to 1990. But since I've heard the discussion this afternoon, I wish I would have come more well equipped with some ideas. And so what one of the things I would like to say is that precede my remarks is that one of the problems that I heard expressed by representatives of government is their problems with various aspects of property tax limitation laws in Oregon. What they are really having a problem with, they've talked about compression. That compression came about with Measure 5. But one of the worst aspects of property tax limitation in Oregon is what was embodied in ballot Measure 50. To me, that particular part of Section 11 of our Constitution is an abomination. And why I say I wish I would have come better equipped is that I have drafts of property tax reform that would have, in a practical way, cure many of the problems implicit in Measure 50 and actually probably improve things for government and fulfill the will of the Oregon voter, what their intention was when they voted for both Measure 5 and then Measure 47, which morphed into Measure 50 under the aegis of the legislature. So I just wanted to say that. I would love to talk to somebody about those ideas, give you something to think about. I think you can see it would reduce our Constitution by about 2,000 words and make that law far more understandable. Anybody who tries to read Measure 50, it just gets cross-eyed after about 10 minutes. It's impossible to read and understand. No constitutional law should be written that way. That's my editorial on that. The reason I came down today, though, is to be a representative of taxpayers, property taxpayers specifically, the Taxpayer Association. We believe that's our raison d'etre, and we want to speak on behalf of the taxpayers. We heard representatives of government, and I'm sure you will hear more, that will talk about the problems with property tax limitation. I have yet to hear anyone speak on behalf of the taxpayer. We've heard talk of compression and awkwardness. Think about the awkwardness of having to reach into your family budget to pay property taxes that have gone up 13% is what Measure 45 intends to bring about. We still have, even with Measure 5 and Measure 50, we have extremely onerous property taxes. They are serious taxes. And the one thing I'd like to remind the members of the legislature of is, and you may or may not agree with me, but I think you probably will, the worst kind of tax, understanding that taxes are necessary, but the very worst kind of tax is a property tax. Specifically, because, well, there's two reasons. First of all, the linchpin of a free society is the ownership of property. The higher the taxes go on the property, that makes the government a participant and a constant lien holder on that property that you never get out from, no matter what your resources are. And that the best illustration of what's wrong with the property tax is that the government relies on it, and let's say that you've worked all your life for your little ranchy or whatever it is, that even if you get in trouble, if you lose your job or you become an invalid or you're just retired and can't work anymore, the one thing that happens as far as your other taxes are is they go down, particularly income taxes, and if we had a sales tax, you'd spend less, your taxes would go down. With property tax, they continue to escalate. They are remorseless. And I think we have an obligation to make sure that that one particular tax is not the one that governments rely on. It's understandable to have a property tax to serve those, to pay for those government functions from which property benefits. Now, in this state, we rely heavily for school taxes on property. That's problematic, and we could argue that, but one of the things that led to Measure 5, of course, was the over-reliance, the dereliction of responsibility by the legislature to fund the school systems properly, making them rely more and more on the property tax, and that's what led to the resistance, the passage of the measure. I personally think, politically, that this is a dead letter. I mean, honestly, if this is referred out, there will have to be a campaign that says your property taxes are going to go up 13%, 20% for schools, 10% for cities. That's going to be a tough sell, and I think perhaps that's anticipated in the construction of this measure. I notice it's not sponsored by any individual legislator. It's sponsored by this committee, and I'm curious as to how many of you on this committee think property taxes ought to go up 13%. I don't know how these things come about with committee sponsorship. What I did, I scratched out sponsored by Committee on Revenue and inserted sponsored by OEA, SEIU, and AFSCME. Because that is generally the impulse, I think, down here to keep taxes to government going. That class has to be paid for. That's just my own cynical view of this. But I really would like to know which of you thinks property taxes should be going up. We truly, truly need tax reform in this state, and actually, I haven't been down here at all this year, but this would be a fascinating committee to hang out and watch, because to me, this is where the action is. This is where the heart of governance is, good government or bad government. And anyway, I just appreciate you hearing from me, but I encourage you not to approve House Joint Resolution 45. It'll save us all a lot of trouble, and I'm pretty sure it isn't going to go anywhere.
Thank you, sir. Questions for Mr. McIntyre? Yes, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I should declare a conflict. I've known Don for a very long time. He's a friend of mine. I agree with him 100% of the time, except when he's wrong.
Well, that's good.
Don, this is a real simple question. You've seen this. You're down here to testify on HGR 45. I know you're opposed to it. You've seen that there's discussion about repeal of the double majority. I assume you're opposed. I haven't talked about it, but I assume you're opposed to that, too. All of these things require referral out.
Yes.
I guess my question to you is, I'm not trying to set you up. I'm not trying to feed a specific answer, but what HGR 45 and HGR 46 on one hand, and repeal of the, or reform of, for lack of a better way, of the double majority, which is less painful to you?
Well, I don't know. That's splitting the baby. I do like the idea of the double majority, simply because I saw that years and years of special elections being held until finally property taxpayers got stiffed again. And it just seems to me that if there's a compelling interest for a tax, if you're not going to go for it in the general election, then it would be good to have a hurdle to climb. The fact is, Scott, and people will argue with me about this, but it is a way of defending against a highly motivated political class that can get out the vote in special elections. Those people who have on their agenda bigger pay and better benefits and union dues if they're successful. And their job is not quite as easy if they have to convince a larger body of the electorate, and that is the double majority. They have to get 25% of the voters plus one. And I think that's healthy. We have to remember that the government is not to represent the government, it's to represent the people. And there should be only so much burden the people have to bear. And it, of course, naturally, from my point of view, it's excessive. That's why we're in the Taxpayer Association. We know that taxes are a necessary evil, but I was sitting out here thinking that excessive taxes are just plain evil.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Further questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McIntyre, I'm just curious why you feel that all taxes are necessarily evil.
No, taxes are a necessary evil. The fact is that it's necessary to fund the government, but it's still evil. The government comes to you with a gun pointed at your head. Pay your taxes. And if you don't pay your taxes, something bad happens to you. Of course, I'm using a figurative expression, but if you don't pay your taxes, you lose your property or you go to jail. So, somebody is telling you to give your money to a common cause. Some of the causes you don't even believe in. So again, we have to have government. It'd be a wonderful world if everyone was so benign that we could all take care of ourselves and competent, and we didn't have criminals and wars to fight, but that's the reason for government. We got to fund it, but we shouldn't go beyond that.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please.
Mr. McIntyre, wouldn't you allow that there are some positive things that come out of the things that our taxes buy?
Of course. Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don, I've been interested in kind of watching the full implementation of Measure 5 over a number of years as it ratcheted in. Of course, the true beneficiaries of not having as much property tax to deduct were the income tax systems, both the federal and the state income tax system. I think at one time we were estimating each year that it was something that was sent in, and I may be getting this mixed up. Well, I was a county commissioner during some of those times. We contacted revenue office, and I think the state was ginning up an additional $25 to $50 million in collections of income taxes as a result of what happened in the reduction of property taxes. That isn't the question, however. The question is that during that period of time, the mid-90s, late-90s, and clear up until the present time, we've enjoyed an inflation rate of about 2%. And now I'm looking at Measure 50, past what, 97, I think. Mm-hmm. Measure 50 that puts an upper limit of 3% of that growth. What happens if we return to a time when we have the Carter era double-digit, very significantly high double-digit inflation? What happens to government services under the 550 scenario? And how would you help us overcome that, Don?
Well, first of all, I would get rid of Measure 50 the way it's written. I'd get rid of the permanent rate. An ideal system is an ad valorem tax, I believe, with limitations on growth. And so the intent of Measure 5 and Measure 47, I think, are still valid. I wasn't a big fan of 47, but the people wanted it. And those two ideas can be combined to the extent that government would benefit from the growth of real market value. And I have no problem with that, but I also like the restraint. There's no reason that the government should grow faster than the economy and the people in their own surroundings. No good reason for that. And we know that the government has been expanding at a rate greater than the growth of the people's income and the economy. But if we have a Carter-era meltdown in terms of inflation. Well, woe is us. I don't think there is any particular law that can react properly to it. What we need to do is make sure it doesn't happen.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
Don, this probably won't surprise you, but I need to share it with you and then get elicit your reaction or response, particularly in light of your testimony relative to the real estate tax always continuing to rise, that they are remorseless. We have had conservative members discussing various kinds of reform, and you've heard today a member of this legislative assembly whom I consider to be extremely conservative fiscally and otherwise, and some of the discussion is surrounding the issue of maybe completely doing away with property taxes on residences, personal residences, such that there would be no property tax on a personal residence. You wouldn't lose your personal residence because of this government agency with a gun at your head, in effect, so to speak. And that would be in exchange for a sales tax based upon consumption, retail consumption, and then to protect local governments would then receive back from the sales tax an apportionment back from the sales tax to compensate local governments, cities, counties, and special districts for the fact that the homes reside in those tax bases of those particular entities. If we could overcome this remorseless real estate tax on your residence, how would you feel about an endorsement of some kind of a substitute, a tax-neutral substitute of a sales tax?
Well, my substitute for a sales tax, first of all, I agree. I think property taxes ought to be reduced somewhat. I don't think they should be eliminated, but perhaps they could be reformed. One idea I was thinking of is, why base it on value? Why not base it on square feet? As you get older, I don't know what the rate would be. I've done some arithmetic. And as you get smaller, you get into a smaller house, your property taxes go down relative to that. But they're manageable. But what I would do, as far as that trade-off is concerned, and one thing I wish you would look at, is the implementation of a flat tax. And forget talking about a sales tax. Just go to a flat tax on income. Years ago, I did the arithmetic on that, and I came up with a 5% flat tax would replace and provide as much revenue, and ultimately more because of economics, than our current so-called progressive system. Just something I'd like to toss out there. But I'd love to see you do the numbers on it. Now, for the people that say, well, that's a flat tax is unfair because it puts a burden on the lowest class. The way you could get around that is make an exemption down low for everybody to make sure that everyone has adequate resources before they start paying their tax. But that would really be simple, and I think it would make Oregon a great place to live.
Mr. Chair, I subscribe to yourself and other members here today that Oregon does in fact have a flat tax. The exemption is $10,000,
right,
and everybody that makes $10,000 has some exemptions down there one way or another. After that, everybody pays 9%.
Right.
It's a flat 9%.
So. Right. But there are so many exemptions that if everything was taxed, there aren't any write-offs, 5% produces a tremendous amount of money, and it's a rate that's tolerable to virtually everyone.
There goes your tax expenditure book, then, Mr. Chair. Out the window.
Yeah, that would not be a loss from my point of view. Thank you. Other questions for Mr. McIntyre? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for your time.
We really appreciate your coming today.
And Mr. Chair, I would like to have Don share some of his ideas relative to reconstructing post-Measures 5 and 50's implementation.
I'd be glad to.
Thank you.
I'll send it down.
Please.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that very much. Also signed up today is Kathy Eaton from the League of Women Voters. Kathy, would you come forward?
Okay. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance chair coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. You all heard the boilerplate that the League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization.
And, Kathy, if you would move the microphone a little bit further away,
all right.
It won't distort quite so much.
I'll be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
I'm here to talk about House Bill 46 because the League is in agreement with a good many people that there is an acute fiscal problem with at least half of the counties in the state because of the loss of their federal forest reserve receipts. And the League also believes that the legislature has the authority to give some flexible alternatives to counties, and we believe that House Bill HJR 46 provides one of those flexible alternatives. I've been listening very carefully to the testimony that you received today from the Association of Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities, and I'm going to take off my League hat, if I may, with some personal comments because I live in Lane County. And Lane County is one of the counties that is specifically affected by the loss, the possible loss of these Federal Reserve receipts. We would lose 25% to 30% of the county employees, and that impacts public safety and social services, the whole gamut of the kinds of services which government needs to protect and to give to its to give to us for which we pay taxes. And as a taxpayer, I expect to pay taxes for government services which affect all of us from the lowest income to the highest income. Also, I am a constituent of the Lane Community College District, which is at compression. It's going to lose another 30 of its staff people. That affects the ability of that very important educational institution in both our county and some adjacent counties to provide the educational background that our citizens need. I have a grandson who goes to LCC with a hope of transferring to the university, but his ability to do that is affected by the fact that programs are going to be cut at Lane Community College, as are the programs at most of the 17 community colleges. This is part of the compression problem with what we have that's been caused by Measure 5 of 1990. So I would add my own personal thought to what the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties said to you, that they had hoped there would be a broader discussion about the whole issues that have come about from Measure 5 and Measure 50 and what might be done with those two measures. I think I'll step back into my League hat now, if I may. We do believe that HJR 46 offers a solution to a very critical problem. There is no guarantee that whether or not the federal government issues a reprieve for a year on the money that would be coming, that is a very big questionable amount of revenue in the future. And the counties and the cities, local government districts need to be assured that they have the ability to provide the services which citizens want to have. And so we certainly encourage you to discuss this matter very carefully and come up with some solutions for local government. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mrs. Eaton? Thank you, Kathy. We appreciate your tireless effort on behalf of the League and the state of Oregon, and your appearance in Salem over and over again, and your work on these measures. One of the things that I would like the League to look into, if they're willing to do it, is the whole issue of federal management of these very, very large pieces of land that they control through the Bureau of Land Management or the Forest Service, which are currently now essentially fallow. because nobody is managing these timberlands. And it would be, I think, useful for the legislature to get some of your smart people's opinion about what might be done to deal with that. Part of the reason, of course, why these counties are in trouble is because the federal government is not making any money off of this land and has failed to, therefore, do its job as a member of the community and the largest landowner in the community to pay its share of the bills.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. I'll put this on the long list we have of issues we really want to tackle. Right now we're looking at redistricting and what you might be doing about that in the future. But this measure before you is extremely critical, and we hope that you will act upon it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Not a question for Kathy, but however, I appreciate her appearance today and her discussion of the possibility of the Federal Forest Safety Net monies being extended 1 year made the vision just flash before my mind of what it must have looked like at the end of year six for Joseph, who was sold into Egypt, of the 7 years of feast before the 7 years of famine. What did that last year look like? Did it look like it was going to rain and they were going to get some, you know, another crop, a final crop? Or did it, you know, was it just all of a sudden cut off? Because I think we're down to that sixth year now, and we're looking at it and we're saying, well, we might have rain this year, we might be able to get it. But, you know, you just can't continue to say that it's never, ever going to famine. Because, you know, I mean, we've been faced this past number of months with the possibility those monies would be gone forever. And then we get 1 year potential reprieve.
And that's what it is.
And I think we better be putting the money in the storehouses as fast as we can, like the grain of Egypt of old. Thank you.
And I like to think of myself as just a minute face of the public. But there are a lot of people who are really concerned about what's going to happen.
Yes, I agree. And if I may add to your metaphor, Representative Butler, Joseph's value to Egypt was precisely his ability to plan ahead and to save for that dismal famine future. And I think that's part of our responsibility to plan ahead and be ready, whether the famine in federal funds comes this year or next, it's coming. Thank you very much. Other issues to come before us. I should ask before we close the public hearing if there's anyone else who would like to be heard on measure HJR 45 or HJR 46. There are two. Yes, please, come forward. And we are running out of time, so I'd ask you to be very, very brief.
Mr. Chair, I will, because I'm due up first next door on energy. For the record, Ralph Groner with AFSCME. Just to comment on measure 46, timber, any help you can give the folks, and those are mostly almost afraid after Don McIntyre talked about unions, to tell you that most of those are my counties. We face 838 layoffs. Those are police. Those are public safety. Those are folks that deal with a wide variety of public interest. I won't say much more than that. We also, I don't disagree with Don McIntyre. Been around since Measure 5. I was the state chair against it as chair of the Board of County Commissioners at the time. I don't want to relive it, the debates with Don. But the fact of the matter is, I think he is right. When it comes to schools in my counties and my cities and special districts, AFSCME at the local government level is the primary union in local government ease in Oregon and not state. We understand the reality of that. I would support anything that would happen. It would help, but I don't think the voters personally would support it. I've been for a gross receipts tax, and some of the discussion you've had here supported sales taxes in the past. I'm one who thinks that if you significantly reduce at the doors, they do say that, reduce my property, I'll support a sales tax. But the truth is, if you're going to reduce a tax, in my opinion, it's the income tax that would stimulate the economy, and we'd have more money in our pockets, and we'd grow this economy. So I'm not here for that purpose. Just to say, I really care about so much that you do help our rural counties. Give the voters an opportunity, and I realize it's here. By the way, when they came out of Egypt, you didn't say something I just read in a book I'm reading. The fact is, they had these laws called the laws they had lived by, and one of them was you will charge no interest of the poor. I never brought my book here when you were all considering that.
Thank you, Mr. Garner. You note that the House did vote to reduce the interest of
the
poor.
Yes, we did.
Last few days. Was there something else on measures, House Joint Resolution 45 or 46 today?
No. That's it.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your...
Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schoenberger, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I guess I'd have to say the Farm Bureau would oppose both 45 and 46. 45 on the basis that if you do this, you're going to let the federal government off the hook. I mean, they need to cut more timber. That's what resolves Measure 45's issue. Need more money, and the money should come from federal government land. So that takes care of that issue. On 46, you're probably going to think me off my rocker on this thing. It was a very engaging discussion and very interesting discussion I had with Mr. McIntyre, and unlike Representative Bruin, I don't know what percentage I would agree with Mr. McIntyre on. But nevertheless, I think there's some, philosophical things that need to be understood, at least from my perspective at least, and that is that property taxes for property-related services are the correct tax, period. Then there's social services, and social services are the services that should be paid for by a person's ability to pay. And that's either an income tax or a sales tax. Either one of those can be constructed so that they're perfectly fair to everybody. You just got to do it right. The problem we were having with Measure 5, we changed from a property tax-based system to a rate-based system that we have now. The problem we had before was that we were trying to fund a social service with a property tax, i.e. schools with property tax. And that's what was driving that up. The other problems we had with that is the automatic increase was 6%. That was too high. The other problem we had was that they could keep voting and voting until they got whatever they wanted. So had we reduced the automatic increase to a reasonable level, and had we limited the number of times that the schools or other governments could have voted or brought it to a vote of the people, still would have been a good system. From my view, ideally, we would be funding schools with a tax based on ability to pay, either the income tax or a sales tax. And the property taxes should pay for all of those property-related services. There needs to be a nexus between what you're paying for and the service that you get. And right now, we still have got them mixed. We need to separate those. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. We appreciate that. And there was one more. Some of us have 3 o'clock meetings, so I would appreciate it if you can be very brief.
Tell Andrea she can take all the time she wants. We leave in 3 minutes.
I can be extremely brief. Andrea, for the record, Andrea Henderson, Oregon Community College Association, and I'm handing out a chart that essentially shows property taxes and the impact on community colleges. The one point I'd like to make is that essentially with the passage of Measure 5, our colleges are primarily funded by property taxes pre-Measure 5. That is no longer the case. Obviously, only about 20% of the college revenue comes from property taxes. The impact has been that a lot of that burden has fallen to our students. You can see there that the burden for the students has gone from 19% up to 30%. While the state legislature has made up some of those revenues, it still is a very difficult situation and makes it less likely for us to provide both for our services, and the ability to pay is being put on our students who have the least ability to pay. So anything that you can do as we look at property tax policy that can help our community college students would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. And your FTE, student FTE is down, is it not?
Yes, it is.
And partly because we're pricing some students out of the market.
Mr. Chair, yes. We have dropped since 2001 from 400,000 Oregonians that we served down to 357,000 Oregonians.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony on these matters. And with that, we're going to close the public hearings on House Joint Resolution 45 and 46. Please don't leave just yet. I want to remind you that we have a tour scheduled tomorrow of the Department of Revenue. Paul, do we need our pith helmets and our hiking boots?
Free samples?
Absolutely. We're going to meet here at 1 o'clock.
Absolutely.
We'll
yes.
go over with Carol and Chris. They'll go with you, and it'll take about an hour.
Okay.
So it's about a five-minute walk.
And so who is
now? It should be like this tomorrow.
So and you wanted to know, you wanted to get a count.
Yeah, I'd like to get a sense of who is going to
who is going to be able to be there tomorrow for this tour. I've got one. I will come.
I think someone wants to know if they're going to be refreshments.
I suspect you can bring a bottle of water with you.
Sure, Mr. Warner.
Sustain you on the five-minute walk.
Representative Rosenbaum's afraid. She's fearful to answer. Are we going to have donuts
sure,
tomorrow?
Like, that's my reputation, that's for sure.
No, but there is no guarantee you'll get to see your own return, though.
Mr. Chair, I will beg off if you don't mind. I have toured them before.
Yeah, you've done it. You're excused.
At 1 o'clock?
At 1 o'clock.
I'll come.
All right. That's three of us. Four.
There's Representative
Five.
Yeah, I've done it before.
Okay. Representative Butler?
I've done it before.
You've done it before. I think there are five of us. I think is what you get is five.
And we're meeting here?
Oh, yes.
Yeah?
Yes, delightful.
We're meeting here?
Very informative.
Meet here, and we'll walk over together. Meet here at 1 o'clock, like your regular meeting time, and we'll walk over.
We'll walk over together.
It'll be an official committee meeting.
So the public will be invited?
The public can be there.
Public is invited. So if the public arrives here at 1 o'clock, they can come along.
Well,
with limitations.
With limitations.
Based on the size of the space, et cetera. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And we're losing our committee and our quorum. So with that,
information meeting. You can't talk about specific.
With that, the committee is adjourned.